Hello and welcome to another episode of Earth 911's Sustainability in Your Ear, the podcast conversation about accelerating the transition to a sustainable carbon neutral society. I'm your host, Mitch Ratcliffe. Thanks for joining in. Let's talk about water pollution. Some of the dirtiest plastic polluted waters lie at the heart of major cities, in ports, marinas, and where wastewater enters the environment. They're hard to keep clean because of the constant activity that adds new waste to these waterways. And the work of cleaning up is wet, cold, and dirty, which makes port and marina cleanups an ideal job for robots. Our guest today, Michael Ahrens, is the co-founder and CEO of Clean Earth Rovers, a Cincinnati, Ohio-based startup that makes two robotic devices for cleaning and monitoring coastal waters. We'll talk about the devices, the rover that can collect up to 100 pounds of waste during an 8-hour shift, and the data pod, a water monitoring buoy that sends data to a mobile app. We'll also cover how the company started, its WeFunder campaign, and where the first orders for rovers and data pods will be deployed. You can learn more about Clean Earth Rovers at cleanearthrovers.com, all one word. That's cleanearthrovers, no space, no dash, .com. Welcome to the show, Michael. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for joining me on the show. We met back in December and started talking about Clean Earth Rovers. It was a really interesting conversation, and I wanted to get you on to talk about it now that you're doing your WeFunder campaign. But first, tell us about your background. How does somebody become the founder of a robotics company focused on cleaning up ports and marinas?
Thank you. No, I'm excited to be here. And also, I think to answer that question, it's a little serendipitous, right? I grew up in the Midwest, very far away from being connected to the oceans, and seeing these issues that we're now trying to solve with Clean Earth Rovers firsthand. And so I was actually inspired to dive into this as a senior in high school at a Jesuit high school in St. Louis called DeSmet. And right before graduation, one of my classmates gave his final public speaking topic on ocean plastics. And I've always been passionate about sustainability, but I was very upset that as an 18-year-old, for the first time, I was just hearing about this major world issue. Mm-hmm. And so I had always also known that I wanted to do something with entrepreneurship. And at the time, I had different ideas for things that I didn't think were really going to impact anybody. But I really wanted to find something that I was passionate about and that kind of fit that mold. And so going into my undergraduate at Xavier University, I jumped right into an entrepreneurship and management major. And from there, just started utilizing the resources around me in the university setting and in the Cincinnati startup community to help grow this idea. And that's kind of where we've gotten today through that.
So you saw business as the way to exercise that passion, but why particularly robots? Did you study robotics or work with robotics experts along the way?
No. So I had never, I think at one point, actually my freshman year of high school, I had attended one or two robotics clubs meetings, but mm-hmm. prior to that had no experience in engineering, no experience in robotics. And when I kind of looked at the problem and looked at who was out there and what they were doing, it just didn't feel like it was going to be efficient or effective enough to actually tackle such a major issue. And so the original idea for Clean Earth Rovers was we were going to build these ginormous autonomous vessels to go and clean up the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. And, after long pathways and business stuff, you realize it's probably not as feasible as you think. But, even kind of tying it back to why robots, right? It's such a massive issue. It can't be managed by hand. We can make dents in it. We can make improvements in it by hand. Yeah. But to really, start knocking away big chunks at the problem, we have to find a way to automate it somehow. And I think robots is a good way to do that.
So when we first talked, you described the rovers as a Roomba for coastal waters that automates water management. Mm-hmm. So the obvious question, how much does a Roomba for a waterway cost, and what do they for?
So right now we're charging anywhere from $15,000 to $30,000 for our rovers, and that's based on the application and the use case that you're looking for. Mm-hmm. So our rovers are not just for plastics and trash. They do a great job of collecting that, but they can also collect algae, dead fish, oil. They can do advanced water quality data sensing, and they can even do remote facility and site infrastructure inspections. So it's really the way we're starting to look at it is a versatile autonomous application for solving all these different pollution or disaster response needs for coastal municipalities.
Well, and I think that's what's really interesting about this is it ends up being kind of a multimodal solution. You also mentioned surveillance, just the fact you could keep an eye on a marina or a waterway with one of these mm-hmm. devices too. Mm-hmm. Another obvious Roomba metaphor question is in a marina in particular, with the slips and all the corners and dead ends that you have, can one of the rovers get stuck there or does it know how to get out?
It does know how to get out. So it uses autonomy through waypoint navigation and tracking. So the way that if a marina were to buy and use our vessels, they would be mm-hmm. Essentially looking at a map of their facility. They would draw, an area in which they want to go and clean. And then the vessel uses, a combination of LiDAR and the positioning autonomy to use collision avoidance and other things to navigate through those waypoints and that path that was planned by the marina operator. So it can get into tight nooks and crannies. And I think we're now up to accuracy of about 3 feet, depending on GPS strength and signals. So
what's involved in the day of using the Clean Earth rover? Do people need to have a staff to go out and remove the stuff that it's collected? And I guess the other question is, how does that compare to having humans do it?
Yeah, both great questions. So I would say this is kind of dependent as well on user, right? So we, for example, have disaster control contractors and response contractors down in Florida. That will be using our devices for algae bloom response, fish kill response, hurricane response. In their interest, they actually want to drive it by hand. So you can stand there all day if you really want to and use a controller to drive it. But then, the use case of a marina or even a municipal team that might be managing it, what their day-to-day might look like is more using it completely autonomously, where you go online, you schedule the waypoints, the device does its thing, you get a notification when it's done, and then the process of emptying it is actually can be done in 10 minutes or less. It's just removing a bag, replacing the bag, and then sending it off on the next mission.
Now, and compared to humans doing this, where and you sent over some math that you shared with me. It ends up costing about $26,000 to do roughly what you can do with the rover for less. But can you describe the physical coverage that one rover can take care of in a regular day?
So the rover right now can do about 20 square feet per minute. And the difference between, cleaning some of this debris or pollution by hand versus using an autonomous vessel to do so, right, is you're limited when you're doing it by hand to as far as you can reach from the dock. And then if you're on a boat, right, your cost of cleanup is rising exponentially. And so, not only do we kind of solve both of those problems, but to our point, you can send this out, it goes anywhere in the water as far away from the dock as you need it to. Mm-hmm. Can capture all the pollutants and everything else, and you don't have to worry about boat rentals and response vessels and things like that, because this is your response vessel, and it's also safer now for the response workers that are trying to clean the pollution out of the water.
And how do they get recharged? Do you have to pull them out of the water in order to do that? Or is it designed to be charged while it's in the water?
It can be charged while it's in the water. It's just as easy as plugging a cord into your wall outlet at home. You just need an extension cord and a power line that goes down to your dock to do that. And if you don't have that, we actually just added like amphibious wheels to the device so that it can be pulled in and out of the water by one person, where there's a boat ramp, and it makes it much easier to manage if you need to take it somewhere else where it needs to be charged.
And tell me a little about the data pod, which is a buoy that collects data, obviously, but what does it tell the user and how can they use that information?
No, that's a great question. So Clean Earth Rovers really has two sides of our business. And although we are called Clean Earth Rovers, we actually start our value proposition offering with this data solution, the data pod. And what that does is it is a small scale, low cost Internet of Things buoy that enables water quality monitoring programs to completely automate their monitoring systems. So right now, by and large, most monitoring programs are sending people all around the city, down to the shorelines, to stick a sensor in the water and write it down in a notebook. It can be more efficient than that. And that's what the DataPod is trying to do, is create a scalable solution where, you know, you're not spending $15,000, $20,000, $40,000 on a buoy just to get the data points you're looking for, but instead you're only spending a couple hundred dollars a month. And so these buoys help monitor temperature, dissolved oxygen, oxygen reduction potential, conductivity, pH, and turbidity. And for any sensor that we're not able to provide on our DataPod technology, you know, this kind of ties back into the rover technology, we're able to equip that with more robust metrics like chlorophyll or TSS or things like that.
And you mentioned turbidity, which would be an indication of how densely polluted the water is?
Yes. So a lot of these metrics will react with each other. And because of how they correlate, you can actually know if something like an algae bloom is taking place. You, to your point about turbidity, can see how, you know, foggy or unclear the water is because of the either nutrient or sediment or whatever type of pollution is there. And what that really allows us to do is it takes, on our user interface or our data dashboard, takes all these metrics into consideration, how they work together. And then it actually notifies the user when we believe there's a pollution event happening or there's a concern with the water. So we're not just building out the infrastructure of data. We're also helping you kind of automate the process of seeing what's going on.
So could the combination of the rover and the data pod tell you, for instance, that you were at risk of an algae bloom because there was too much nitrogen in the water?
Yes, it could. Especially, you know, to my point about the rover, right? If you wanted it monitoring nitrate or phosphate levels, and especially even chlorophyll levels, you'd be able to absolutely tell that with the combination of dissolved oxygen and turbidity and ORP, all the differences in the water chemistry that are creating and causing an algal bloom. And that may be, you know, a way for us to then say, we believe there's an algae bloom taking place. You should, you know, close the shoreline, take water samples, see if it's toxic, take all those further future next steps.
So you've announced that you've got some early customer orders for about $300,000 worth of equipment. What kinds of organizations are customers? Are they primarily city or port managers that are trying to clean up public waterways, or are industrial companies thinking about using this to monitor where they might have outlets to the environment?
I think the industrial companies are definitely a potential player in this in the future. But for now, our beachhead market, or kind of who we're targeting at first, is coastal municipalities that have, very high levels of coastal water or high concentration of beaches and shorelines throughout their area. And on top of that, the first revenue contract that we have is with a disaster response contractor down in Naples, Florida. And that's going to be a distributorship model that we're going to test, where they then can help provide our equipment and sell it to the municipalities in their region, other contractors in the response region, and see how that works for us.
The question occurs to me, how many rovers are needed to really take care of just, say, U.S. waterways? We must be talking, if not tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of mm-hmm. rovers.
The number is quite large. So we at one point were heavily focused on providing this as a solution for just the marina industry in the U.S. And when we were looking at the impact and the numbers there, there are roughly 14,000 marinas around the U.S. and 11,000 of them are coastal. If we were to provide one rover to all 11,000 of those marinas, we would be making a year over year. And again, there are a lot of hypotheses and assumptions here, but we would be making a 15% waste reduction from the U.S.'s contribution to marine debris.
Just one per marina, but if you got more densely populated, you could do more.
Right. And again, there are a lot of assumptions there and hypotheses, but we estimate that 11 billion tons of marine debris enters the ocean annually. And out of that, 6.6 billion stays within coastal waterways. And a constant cycle, right, of being smashed against the beach and then pulled back out and going through all the different channels that are there. And so that's also why, and part of why we scaled down our solution to focus on coastal waterways, is we actually believe that this is where the issue is most prominent, and it's better to catch it before it ends up in a place like the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. Scaling down, starting smaller, and taking a strength by numbers approach in doing that.
Yeah, I want to talk more about the progress you're making in a moment, but we're going to take a quick commercial break. We'll be right back. And we are back to continue the conversation with Michael Ahrens, co-founder and CEO of Clean Earth Rovers. You know, Michael, this is an example of an Internet of Things device for the environment. And we're hearing a lot more about the role of technology in addressing all of the problems that we've created for ourselves, from pollution to climate change. What's your assessment of where we are in the evolution of the Internet of Things, wireless coverage, robotics technology? Has it changed our potential to use machines to clean up the human mess?
I think it has. I think that we've come a very long way in just the past, 15, 20 years with things like robotics and autonomy, where not just from a technology standpoint, but also from a societal standpoint, we're at the point where we're ready to accept the idea that robots can do things sometimes better than we can. And I think that with looking at issues that are as big as, marine debris or coastal water management, it is really difficult to do all of that efficiently by hand without some sort of automation in place. And so I think in our case, and in many cases, especially when it comes to clean tech or ag tech and other industry verticals, it does make sense to start integrating autonomous vehicles, robotics into our lives to help improve what we're currently capable of doing.
I don't get the impression that a lot of, and I live in a port city, so I'm familiar enough to make this statement. I don't get the impression that humans are doing a lot of this cleanup manually anyway. Do you see an emergence of spending by cities, by industry and so forth to begin to address this problem? I mean, is the funding going to be there to begin to put enough rovers out there to make that 15% difference?
I definitely hope so. And I also do believe so. I mean, we've started to see data and use cases where municipalities are spending some big dollars on solutions to combat marine debris and other forms of pollutants. I think, you know, Newport Beach here in Southern California, one of the local municipalities that we're doing a pilot program with, and they spent, I want to say back in 2014, about $2 million on a Mr. Trash Wheel device, which is a system that is, you know, larger than ours, located in Baltimore Harbor. And I think once it gets installed in Newport Beach, it'll be the second in the U.S., which is very exciting that they're taking, you know, all these steps to combat marine debris and pollution. But it just shows and kind of continues to validate that what we're doing, one, it creates a lot of economic losses and damages to a number of different industries and sectors. And because of that, these municipalities are starting to find ways to mitigate and manage the problem as it increasingly becomes worse.
Do you find that there's funding emerging for cleanups through, say, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration or state governments, or are there NGOs out there? In other words, are there ways that we can organize to put this funding to work?
There is. I see a lot coming from NOAA. NOAA has a marine debris grant program that typically gets issued, I believe it's at least annually. And that is a couple of million dollars that they're allocating every year towards this. I would say right now, the biggest lead is nonprofits that are trying to take this up. And so, again, I love nonprofits. I actually participate in beach cleanup events myself, but at the same time, I see there's still a better way that we can do it. And so, you know, even if you had an autonomous vessel alongside volunteers at a beach cleanup, or even an autonomous vehicle skimming the sand on the beach, right, there are ways that we can help ourselves improve our efficiency and also make a bigger dent in this ginormous issue.
I want to turn to how you've grown the company, and which leads to some interesting questions about funding that solution we were just talking about. You started Clean Earth Rovers in 2019 with David Constantine and have raised about $250,000 in financing. Mm-hmm. You're going to market, you've got the product out there, and now you're doing some new fundraising on WeFunder, which is a crowdsourcing platform. Why is crowdsourcing the right way to go for you guys right now?
I think there's a number of considerations that ultimately led us to crowdfunding. Mm-hmm. You know, it is a little non-conventional or non-traditional when you look at startup-based financing and venture mm-hmm. capital. But when you look at right now, the macro economy and kind of what's going on, especially in venture capital or VC space, it's becoming a lot harder, especially for early stage startups, to raise the money that they're looking for in the traditional practice of fundraising. And so that's part of the bigger consideration. But then the other piece of it is, you know, we are a social venture, right? We started Clean Earth Rovers because we want to make impact. We want to change the way that we are currently managing some of these major issues and better people's lives. And so I think that also plays a big role into why we opened this up on a crowdfunding campaign, is because now our family, our friends, our customers, people who are not angel investors and venture capitalists can actually get involved in supporting this and investing in solutions that they believe in. And so kind of democratizing that for more of the broader community that we've interacted with and that has supported us, I think was important. And it's proven to be successful so far. We're making good headway on our campaign right now.
So what will you do with the $250,000 if you succeed in raising it?
$250,000 will go towards probably some intellectual property protection.
Okay.
We'll use it to continue to build out hardware, starting to build inventory, starting to make improvements. And then also we do have some early stage team members that we've started to hire on that will continue to need support. So sure. Team support, human capital, those types of things.
If the orders take off, will you need to raise more money, or are you basically looking at being able to grow organically on sales?
There's a chance that we'll still need to raise more capital, but I believe that we can also grow organically at the same time. And one thing that's interesting, and we'll be validating this model over the next 12 months with the distributor, but mm-hmm. You know, that gives us a lot of capital upfront on those sales that we do, which we're then able to pour back into building out the data side of our business, which mm-hmm. is a recurring revenue model, a data as a service model. And so because we're getting a lot of cash flow upfront on our Rover sales, and then we're pouring that back into a recurring revenue stream, I believe that would enable us to, you know, grow quite efficiently and also maybe even bootstrap this moving forward.
The question that occurred to me as I was preparing for the conversation is, how can we as individuals potentially participate in solving this problem? And by the way, folks, just as a matter of disclosure, I did put a small, very modest investment into the WeFunder campaign. So disclosure, I have a conflict of interest, but it's an important discussion to have. Could we set up a nonprofit or regional nonprofits to collect enough to populate waterways with rovers and monitors so that we're doing a better job of managing our waterways?
Yes. I think from a personal standpoint of how people can get involved, how they can help combat this this problem, I mean, like I said, I encourage people to, you know, join beach cleanup events where they can. I encourage people to take steps at home to reduce their plastic footprint and things like that. And I think as well, nonprofits and, you know, community-based events and organizations are going to play a huge lead in, you know, helping us grow. And we've already started to see that as well with, you know, some interest from a couple of different nonprofit groups around the country that are looking to do some work with us. So,
So if one of our listeners wanted to start a cleanup program, mm-hmm. what's your advice for doing so?
I would reach out to your local municipality and maybe even consult with a couple existing nonprofits that are in your area. There's, you know, a pretty clear pathway that's been carved on that process and how to do it. And they will happily help you work through that, get the right permitting, set up the community event, get the sponsors for it. It is a fun thing to do. I've never led one or organized one myself, but I have looked into it before. I've partaken in quite a few, and it's a good way to build community.
So the next step beyond those nonprofit efforts would be if somebody thought, I'd like to clean up waterways as an entrepreneurial activity, could they buy a fleet of rovers from you and manage that on behalf of a set of customers? Or is that something that conflicts with the way that you go to market now?
We're not opposed to people buying our devices from us. We actually encourage that. We want them to own and manage and operate them. Mm-hmm. But there probably would be restrictions to some extent or manner of, you know, renting them out, leasing them out, unless they were a certified distributor or service provider. And that is one thing that we've talked about is it possible not just to have, you know, distributorships, but mm-hmm. also a service provider network where we have people that are not reselling them, but are reselling them as a service. And, you know, we get a commission or base pay off of each, you know, service that they provide.
Right. So you could, for instance, let them mark up your monthly data reporting capability and or mm-hmm. provide them a discount so that they could mark it up to make the profit. Okay. Well, so when is the WeFunder campaign going to close?
So WeFunder actually, I think, gives us as long as 6 months to complete our raise. So we will be on there for quite some time. Right now, we are still in what's called testing the waters. So mm-hmm. until we hit our first $50,000 in commitments, we then will have to do some paperwork filing to go live on the WeFunder platform, where you know the broader community can see it and start putting money in. And we're close to that threshold, so which is exciting.
I've been tracking it, and then I've got my fingers crossed for you. So how can our listeners follow along as Clean Earth Rovers grows?
Follow us on LinkedIn, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. We've got all the social media platforms, and they're all just at Clean Earth Rovers. And I would say as well, LinkedIn is likely where we're the most active. So if you're on the professional network platform, definitely stay tuned there and continue to check us out.
Well, Michael, thanks very much for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Mitch. It was great.
We've been talking with Clean Earth Rovers co-founder and CEO, Michael Ahrens. Visit cleanearthrovers.com, all one word, no space, no dash, cleanearthrovers.com to learn more about the rovers, the data pod, and their WeFunder campaign. You know, carbon emissions get the headlines, but the climate crisis involves many polluted natural systems that contribute to the planet's inability to process those emissions. Water pollution, from plastics and microplastics that choke and kill wildlife, to elevated acidity, nitrogen, and CO2 levels, must be addressed to restore the ocean's natural role as a carbon sink. A lot of attention is focused on the seven great garbage patch gyres in our oceans. But that plastic and trash can be stopped closer to shore with robotics technology and an investment in preventing pollution, cleaning up oil and nitrogen from farmlands and industry. Clean Earth Rovers represents a way to do that cleanup work that, frankly, just goes unaddressed today. So what can we do in our communities? There is some funding available from government, but the solution to our local issues will require either more nonprofit fundraising or an entrepreneurial investment in cleanup capabilities. Michael suggested in another conversation that the first step in many locations would be to use the Datapod device to monitor the water. Publishing that information, taking it to a city or county council meeting, sending it to your state or national representatives, and using it to reach out to other sources of funding may be the best way to kickstart a program where you live or work. There's a lot to do, folks, and I hope that this idea and the information that Michael shared will help you think about what you can do with your local waterways. You know, environmental awareness and responsibility need to go mainstream. I hope you'll take a moment to share this podcast by writing a review on your favorite podcasting platform. You folks are the amplifiers that spread more ideas to create less waste. Please tell your friends, family, and coworkers they can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Audible, and other fine purveyors of podcast goodness. I will really appreciate your support, as will the entire team at Earth 911. I'm Mitch Ratcliffe. This is Earth 911, and we'll be back with another innovator interview soon. In the meantime, folks, take care of yourself, take care of one another, and let's all take care of this beautiful planet of ours. Have a green day.